hosting the Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, traffic deaths in America hit a 15-year high this year. And despite local programs like Vision Zero, more people are speeding and driving drunk. Jen White shares your stories and finds out what's behind the surge. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Moderna has gotten some criticism for mostly distributing its vaccine to wealthier countries. Now, the drug maker is planning to make its vaccine more available in developing nations. In related news, Pfizer authorized its antiviral COVID pill to be manufactured and sold in 95 developing nations to make up over half the world's population. Still, the gap between poor and wealthy nations when it comes to vaccine access is huge. Under 5% of people in lower-income countries have received at least one dose of the vaccine. We're talking now about access to the COVID vaccine and to healthcare in lower income countries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have friends or family somewhere in the world where vaccines are hard to come by? What are you hearing from them? Do you think lower income countries should have to pay for the vaccine, or should they be provided free or at lower cost? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Prashant Yadav is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, an affiliate professor of technology and operations management at INSAD. He is an expert in health supply chains. Prashant, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you wrote, glad to be here. You co-wrote a piece back in April of 2020 now, while vaccines were still hypothetical, that the world needed to plan for distribution of these vaccines in lower income countries. Did we ultimately fall down on the job?
Yes. So in April of 2020, we said, here are some things that we worry about, the scarcity in countries around the globe, which will not be able to access vaccines on their own. They will need some kind of financial support, some kind of purchasing support. And if we don't fix that, we're going to put everybody in the world in peril. And that didn't happen for a variety of reasons. I think people tried, governments around the country, supranational entities, such as the new COVAX mechanism, which was created. But just the sheer scarcity of production and supply has not allowed us to do many of the things that we had laid out in our April 2020 article. And we still continue to face that as a problem.
And we have Moderna saying, yes, we're going to take a step, or we've got a deal in the works to distribute a vaccine in developing countries. What are you looking at as companies like Moderna and the other big vaccine manufacturers try to ramp up production and then point it in the direction of these countries that are very much under vaccinated?
Yeah, so I think announcements such as what Moderna made for putting the doses that need to go into developing countries ahead of the orders that need to be fulfilled in high-income countries, and similar announcement by Pfizer, other companies which have highly efficacious and safe vaccines. I think those are our only chances of solving this in the short term. Because in the short term, we need vaccines from companies who have large established manufacturing sites. And all we are asking is, of the output that's coming out of those production lines, can we send some of that output to the countries which have very low coverage versus keeping that output as buffer or as additional stock just in case for high-income countries. And we shift to the medium term, then I think we start seeing a different picture. Then we ought to think about not just getting some of the production output from the large factories that Moderna and Pfizer, BioNTech and others have created, but also think about, should there be manufacturing plants in regions of the world which haven't had sufficient access, whether it's in Latin America or Africa or some parts of Central Asia, and what would that look like? How would we create that? So I think there are two issues here. One is a short term and one is a medium term.
How about distribution now? Once vaccines hopefully get to some of these countries, these lower income countries, is there the public health infrastructure in place to get those shots delivered to people before the shots expire?
Yeah, so there are two things at play. One is, I think this is the kind of thinking which made us worry about, should we be using Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna's shots in developing countries which don't have the kind of infrastructure that is needed? They require ultra cold chain. We don't have that. And that, in a way, put the developing countries at the back of the queue because we didn't necessarily prioritize such vaccines for them. So yes, infrastructure is a challenge. The current infrastructure in many of the countries is designed largely for vaccinating kids. So it's a routine immunization for children. Converting that to vaccinate adults is not straightforward and simple, but it's very doable. And many agencies are working on it and are doing it. That doesn't mean the problem has been entirely solved. But at the same time, I think the dynamic that because there isn't enough infrastructure, we should therefore wait and hold on to the doses because until we have the infrastructure ready, let's not send it. That keeps us stuck in the circular reference problem as to let's not send the vaccines, we don't have infrastructure, but we don't have infrastructure planning in place because we don't know when vaccines are coming. Mm. So I think we've got to live with the infrastructure that we have. We have to do something ingenuous, creative, and we have to do something which is frugal and make it work with whatever way we can.
I've heard some public health concerns that if we have very large unvaccinated problems here in the United States or anywhere in the world, it raises the risk of new strains of COVID being able to evolve. It ends up becoming a threat, maybe even to countries that are better vaccinated. Do you hope that that line of thought kind of lights a fire under people and gets them to try to solve these problems sooner than later?
Yeah, I think the science is clear in this. I mean, as long as there are large populations around the world who remain unvaccinated, there will be new variants. We know some of the new variants that have come up, where they evolved from, and such variants will continue to emerge. And our sense of belief and confidence that because we have a large part of our population vaccinated with two doses, or in some cases with the third booster dose, we are safe. I think that will be eroded. That confidence will get eroded quickly once we have more variants emerge. So I think it is important to keep in mind that unless we can solve it for many countries where the vaccination rates are really low, we are not going to see an end to this pandemic or even a state where we can all start feeling safe. Now, that doesn't mean that just providing vaccines to the countries is the only challenge we're facing. There have to be other things such as creating demand, solving vaccine disinformation, and other things in those countries.
We're talking to Prashant Yadav about lack of access to the COVID vaccine in lower income countries around the world and the effort to overcome that hurdle. Prashant is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and an expert in healthcare supply chains. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how this all works, how to get vaccines to countries all over the world, even where there's not much access right now? What do you think should be done to make the COVID vaccine more accessible in poor countries? Do you think wealthier countries or the pharmaceutical companies should foot some, all of the bill when it comes to making vaccines available in countries that maybe can't afford to buy them all? Call in now at 800-642-1234 if you're from or if you have friends or family in one of these lower-income countries that doesn't have access to vaccines. Love to hear what you are seeing. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk now with Prashant Yadav. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and an expert in healthcare supply chains. We're talking about access, lack of access in many cases, to COVID vaccines in lower income countries around the globe. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions on the topic and maybe your experiences, or if you have contacts, friends or family in countries with less access to vaccines. Love to hear what's going on at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Prashant, are you optimistic that these hurdles are going to get overcome anytime soon, by the end of this year or early 2022?
I am optimistic about some things, but I'm not as optimistic about others. So, for example, we are seeing a lot of progress on vaccine companies, prioritizing developing country access. More importantly, the U.S. government donating or at least prioritizing vaccines from both Pfizer and Moderna, the COVAX initiative trying to get more supplies. So on vaccine supplies, things are progressing. There are, like you pointed out earlier, there are still some infrastructure constraints that we need to have a more systematic look at to overcome them. But then I think there are also things such as syringe shortages, which have recently come to light. And I think this is something we've talked about before, that the specialized kinds of syringes that are required, for example, for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine in countries which require injection safety, so they require syringes that are auto-disabled. Now we are running into a very scarce supply situation for syringes. So I think we have to solve a lot of problems together with a systems view. And sometimes my worry is, or my slight lack of optimism is, in trying to solve one bottleneck, we solve that problem and then something else pops up dynamically. And then are we going to be able to solve all of them together? Another promising thing is the oral pills that have come out, the antivirals, both from Merck and from Pfizer, and the work that the two companies have done in licensing them out to a large number of manufacturers. That is promising. That may create access at least to the oral treatments quicker than there has been for vaccines.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sid is with us in Green Bay. Sid, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Sid?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting conversation that you guys are having right now. I'm originally from India, and I've been in the United States for the last 7 years. I work and live in the Green Bay area in Wisconsin, and it's amazing how stark the difference is in the vaccine rollout here versus in a country like India, right? I think the guest spoke about how pharmaceutical companies should be or can they bear the brunt or take over the expenses of actually having vaccines distributed and produced and distributed in developing countries, right? I'm not sure if that could be a good approach, but I think what the developed countries can do is that they could make sure that the vaccines at least are reaching these developing countries. My mom and my sister live in India, and they were able to get their vaccines because they were probably like the first in line, and they were really proactive about getting their vaccines first. But I have a bunch of cousins who had to wait for months and months to actually get their vaccines.
Sid, thanks a lot for calling in. And I wanted to bring up actually India, Prashant, so thanks for bringing that up, Sid. India, as I understand it, has a pretty big pharmaceutical manufacturing base. A lot of the world relies on India, but India needs vaccines itself. What are you watching for in that country?
So India, in some ways, is a place which has a lot of manufacturing capacity for vaccines. Some of that they have put to use for making COVID vaccines. In that sense, for countries in the income category of India, which is, you know, lower middle income countries, India is probably the farthest ahead because of its own manufacturing. But at the same time, India has a large population. And for being able to vaccinate more than 1 billion people, this required far more capacity than perhaps what the government of India could put to bear for COVID vaccines. And in a sense, what it did was that India, which is also the big vaccine factory for most of the developing world. So in the developed world, we get our vaccines from companies that are located in the US, in the EU, in Japan, and other places. But when you go to developing countries in Africa and Latin America, many of the vaccines do come from India, the childhood vaccines. So India stopped exporting for some period of time when it was focusing its own populations first. And that meant the global initiative called COVAX, which was designed to provide vaccines to countries around the world, didn't get sufficient supplies from India. And that put everybody in a state of jeopardy. But at the same time, it was understandable for India to do what it was doing, which is to prioritize and get the billion people in India vaccinated. So it was a very challenging dilemma that the government of India had faced. But at the same time, to answer Sid's question, I think India has a far better situation than many other countries do. India also has a couple of homegrown vaccines that they've developed, one which has been approved, a couple of them which are under development, one large manufacturing company, another one coming up. So I think things look quite promising in India. I think what we want to see is India continuing to play its role as the vaccine factory to the world and exporting to countries in Africa and other places, and then also other countries to emulate that model and create their own vaccine manufacturing networks.
Sid, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jane in Madison. Jane, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Jane?
I have a comment. I have been thinking about the lack of vaccine development in other continents like Africa. I've not heard of any manufacturer of vaccines in Africa. I was wondering if it would be feasible for companies such as Pfizer to have a subsidiary in continent that, like Africa, maybe South America, that does not have manufacturing ability.
Jane, I got you. We don't have too much time left. But Prashant, what did you think of? What would you think of an existing company like a Pfizer getting some capacity in Africa to manufacture their vaccines?
Absolutely. I think that's a direction, that's a line of thinking we all have to focus on. I think both Pfizer and Moderna and Pfizer's partner BioNTech have announced plans to start their manufacturing partnerships in Africa in more than one location in South Africa and Senegal and Rwanda. But the big question remains, what will be the timeline for it? To have such plants, we need workforce. We need people who know chemistry, who know manufacturing, who know laboratory, who know regulatory setup. So that workforce development is not at a stage where you can have that going right away. Also, to set up these plants, you need to think about what will they do after COVID. So will these plants run completely dry after the demand for COVID vaccines starts to dissipate a little bit? Or are we going to design them flexible enough so then they can manufacture other vaccines, such as, you know, for yellow fever or diphtheria or other kinds of diseases? And if they do, then it may require slightly more capital expenditure. It may also require us to wait a little bit longer because the equipment then will maybe take a couple of months more. So those are complex trade-offs, which I think companies like Pfizer, others, their partners in Africa are dealing with. But then it's not just Pfizer, BioNTech, and the larger companies. There are also some homegrown companies in Africa which are coming up and saying, we want to try it on our own. So I think we've got to accept both models of how this manufacturing expansion in Africa, Latin America will happen.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Prashant Yadav, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development, looking at the effort to provide vaccines in lower-income countries around the world. A few teams might stand out when you think about the most successful programs in sports. The New York Yankees for a while there, the Green Bay Packers, the U.S. women's soccer team, UW-Whitewater, wheelchair basketball could easily join that list. Megan Hart has more on the return of a program that's won a combined 16 national titles.
Medalist Christina Schwab says there's a common misconception that wheelchair basketball is a slow sport, but you don't have to watch the Warhawks for long to figure out that's anything but true. Schwab is a Wisconsin native and now head coach of the women's team at UW-Whitewater.
When you come and the first time you see wheelchair basketball, you're going to notice the chairs and you're going to notice like all the contact and people falling down. And then once you get past that kind of like, whoa moment, you're going to realize that it's basketball.
Maida McCabe fell in love with the sport for its physical nature.
There's moments where we're all diving for the ball, we're falling over, we're crashing into each other. So it's very, very intense. And that's part of the reason why I like it, just because I'm very competitive.
Like other players, the freshman from Washington, D.C. says the wheelchair basketball program is a big part of the reason she's at UW-Whitewater. She's getting ready to play her first college game, with eight teams from around the country descending on South Central Wisconsin for a tournament that starts tomorrow. McCabe and her teammates lifted weights and tuned up their wheelchairs on Friday.
15 seconds, let's go! Push yourself!
She's a little nervous, but excited too.
I'm confident that we will do well and that we've grown so much as a team that we're going to do amazing.
But even more experienced players haven't seen much competition recently. Last season was canceled due to COVID-19. Junior Grace Altrock says it was really tough when the pandemic cut the 2020 season short just before the national championship. She's looking forward to this weekend.
I have family coming up from Nebraska because that's where I'm originally from. And so it's my 10th year playing, and so I'm just really excited overall.
Before she started playing wheelchair basketball in sixth grade, Altrock says she sometimes felt left out since she couldn't participate in sports.
I immediately fell in love with the sport, knowing that there are people that are disabled like me and that I can do everything that I want to do, but I just do it in a different way.
Altrock said it was a huge honor when she was recruited to play at UW-Whitewater. The Warhawks began their adaptive recreation program in 1973, and now two banners hang in the gym, highlighting their many titles. The UW-Whitewater men and women last won championships in 2016 and 2014, respectively. Freshman Cameron Poole says it means a lot to wear the purple and white.
Just the legacy that other players left behind. Hopefully I'll leave one of my own behind too, maybe a championship or two, maybe three. But it just feels great to be able to play for a university that supports the wheelchair basketball team as much as the one here does.
And for the Illinois native, something else helped set UW-Whitewater apart.
You know, I came here and I was like, what differentiates Whitewater from like a University of Illinois or a University of Alabama? We're a D3 school, so they can't offer, you know, athletic scholarships. They don't have all the big fancy facilities, but they turn out Paralympic athletes like crazy.
Five former UW-Whitewater players were on the U.S. men's wheelchair basketball team that won a gold medal at the Tokyo Paralympics this year. Schwab was on the sidelines as a coach. Senior Ryan Gladchuk began attending wheelchair basketball camp at UW-Whitewater when he was 12. There are some strong collegiate programs out there, but at a recent practice, he said the Warhawks are way ahead of most opponents when it comes to legacy. The chemistry major and his teammates practice every weekday morning. Plus, they complete two lifting sessions and three scrimmages each week. Players say wheelchair basketball at UW-Whitewater is just like playing any other collegiate sport. For Gladchuk, that includes the rush he feels competing at home.
There's a whole gym cheering for you, and your first experience at a home tournament is just so much more fun. You have all your friends and family watching you play, and everything you've worked for is like they can finally show it.
The tournament will take place tomorrow and Saturday in Whitewater. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, some people will hit the road or the skies to travel over the next month of holidays. We'll get the latest predictions on how many people are going to travel and lots of advice if you're thinking about buying a plane ticket. You can start the conversation right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your travel plans or lack of same. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and our guest cookbook author says, let's keep Thanksgiving simple. Get some great ideas for a delicious holiday meal without a whole lot of hassle. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, are you confused about crypto? You've got lots and lots of company. We're going to help understand the basics of Bitcoin and other digital currencies and how big a financial player they might be down the road. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin schools got their annual report cards this week. We'll talk about what they tell us about the pandemic's impact on learning in districts around the state. First, back in July of 2010, you could buy Bitcoin for 0.08 of a penny. If you bought $100 worth, you'd have about 125,000 Bitcoin. According to the website Motley Fool, that investment would have been worth $7.9 billion earlier this week. Not a bad 11-year return on investment. How in the world does something like that happen? Also, what is Bitcoin? The short, simple answer, it's a digital currency, also known as a cryptocurrency. So what does that mean? How about blockchain, non-fungible tokens? Like it or not, crypto is pushing deeper into the American mainstream. Just yesterday, the owner of the Staples Center in Los Angeles announced the venue will be renamed Crypto.com Arena. Axios says the 20-year deal is worth more than $700 billion. We're going to pick it all apart and hopefully get a better understanding of what's going on here. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about cryptocurrencies? Are there weird terms you've heard about and don't know what they mean? Do you own any cryptocurrencies? Have you thought about buying them? Why did you get involved? Is this all too new and unfamiliar? You're going to stick with what you know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Vivian Fang is an associate professor and the Honeywell Professor in Accounting at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. She teaches a course on crypto. Vivian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the introduction.
We saw a survey come out from an industry group of people finding out that a lot of us don't know much about cryptocurrency. 98% of people lack an understanding of basic crypto concepts. So let's start at the very beginning with that in mind, Vivian. What do we mean when we say cryptocurrency?
Absolutely. Let me start with the basics. So cryptocurrencies are decentralized digital currencies that rely on cryptography for security. So I always say that there are three special things about cryptocurrencies. First, they're virtual, meaning that they have no physical forms. There are no bills and no coins for you to see. Second, all cryptocurrencies are secure through cryptography, meaning that encryption techniques are used to ensure that records of cryptocurrency transactions are not tampered with. Third, most cryptocurrencies are decentralized, meaning that there is no central issuing agency like the Federal Reserve Bank or central clearing agencies like banks or credit card companies behind cryptocurrencies. So they entirely rely on the distributed ledger technology, typically a blockchain technology to record transactions.
And blockchain is a word that's key to this and another kind of confusing one. Can you put that in radio host terms that I can understand?
Yeah, absolutely. What's a blockchain? A blockchain, in simple terms, is a multiple-party data sharing platform. So if you have a lot of transactions that involve multiple parties, blockchain could come in very handy. So new data can only be uploaded to the chain if the participating computers on the chain agree. Existing data cannot be edited or modified afterwards. In more technical terms, a blockchain is a distributed, append-only ledger of provably signed, sequentially linked, and secure transactions that are replicated across a network of computers. And updates are determined not by a human, a government, or any other central authority, but by a software-driven consensus. And this consensus in the Bitcoin version of blockchain is commonly referred to as mining, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. And what is mining? Mining is basically a bunch of computers raising their computing power, trying to solve a mathematical puzzle to find a missing piece.
The best known cryptocurrency is one you and I have both mentioned already, Bitcoin. How many others? How much has this exploded into other kinds of coin or whatever they're being called?
Yeah, absolutely. Bitcoin, introduced in 2009, was the first real cryptocurrency and remains to be the most popular one with the largest market cap. Well, today, I guess Bitcoin dipped below $60,000. So the market cap is just a bit over $1 trillion. And the second most popular cryptocurrency is Ether, which builds on the Ethereum blockchain. And Ethereum has the second largest market cap just behind Bitcoin, which is around $480 billion today. And there's this very interesting difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum. Now, Bitcoin was intended to be a currency from the get-go, but Ethereum was actually created to allow developers to build and publish smart contracts on the network, which is why it is often described as a programmable blockchain. And the Ether is actually the token used on this network to facilitate operations. And for this reason, Bitcoin tends to attract general investors and Ethereum tends to attract investors who are more into technology. And like you said, right, there are many, many other alternative coins and tokens. As of today, I believe there are over 14,000 types of coins and tokens traded on various exchanges and platforms. And I obviously don't have time to comment on every single one of them. But let me just highlight a few interesting ones.
Go for it.
So first, there's Litecoin. The thing about Litecoin is that, as you can probably tell from its name, it confirms transactions much, much faster than Bitcoin. There is another popular coin these days, Solana, which positions itself as a better and faster version of Ethereum. So it is a close competitor of Ethereum. There is Mana, which is a token for Decentraland, a platform that allows its users to buy and sell virtual properties. It is a very interesting token, especially if you're into the whole concept of metaverse. There is this Binance coin, which is a utility token used on Binance, a crypto trading exchange. And of course, there are meme coins like Dogecoin, Shiba Inu, Squid, which are named after many animals that you can think of. The thing about these meme coins and tokens is that they're highly subject to pump and dump schemes, so you have to be careful with them.
We're talking to Vivian Fang from the University of Minnesota, looking at cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, Ether, Dogecoin, and all the rest. And you could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. If you find it all confusing, you are very much not alone, according to surveys. Have you invested in one of these cryptocurrencies? Have you bought something with them? Do you accept one, maybe Bitcoin, where you work? Does your line of work require you to use these kind of tokens? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Vivian, when I think of currency, I think of, you know, dollars and cents. And one thing I can do with those is walk into a place and exchange them for goods and services. Or I could do that sort of virtually with a credit card. How common is it for people to just be able to buy stuff with Bitcoin or other virtual currencies?
Well, just like how you spend fiat currencies like US dollars, you can spend cryptocurrencies at many online businesses now. Thanks to PayPal, many online businesses now take major cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum for payment. Last year, PayPal introduced checkout with crypto service, so you can easily spend cryptocurrencies online while PayPal is accepted. And if you like to buy and sell cryptocurrencies or trade them, there are many places that allow you to do that. You can transact cryptocurrencies through platforms like Robinhood, PayPal, Square, or Coinbase, or you can do it locally. I believe that there are crypto ATMs in almost every state now.
We got a Facebook comment from Pete who says, how and why are cryptocurrencies so volatile? What's their real value? So kind of two separate questions there, really. First of all, yeah, we see a lot of volatility in the values of a lot of these coins. Why is that?
Yes. So that is a very good question. It's also a very tough question to answer. For assets like stock, right, we can apply valuation techniques to get a sense of whether they're overpriced or underpriced. Right, I teach some of these valuation techniques in my class. And for fiat currencies like US dollars, the Fed plays a big role in deciding its value. Unlike stock or fiat currencies, cryptocurrency values are mainly affected by supply, the market's demand, and competing cryptocurrencies, which makes it very difficult to come up with a precise number. Now, on the one side of the argument, cryptocurrencies are of great value to people like libertarians or cypherpunks. Those are the folks who created cryptocurrencies in the first place, because they represent a truly decentralized currency that is free from government intervention. So you will always have people behind cryptocurrencies if they subscribe to the same philosophy or ideology. Cryptocurrencies are also of value because they cannot serve as medium of exchange, and they're anti-inflationary by nature. For example, Bitcoin. Bitcoin is capped at 21 million, and you can't go over that. And of course, on the other side, most cryptocurrencies have no intrinsic value. This is because they do not generate cash flows, nor do they have stable value. And its price, you know, as you mentioned, can be all over the place. So I do believe for cryptocurrencies to move towards mainstream acceptance, a certain measure of price stability needs to be achieved.
We're talking about cryptocurrency, blockchain, and more, trying to make sense of it all with Vivian Fang, Associate Professor and Honeywell Professor in Accounting at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about digital currency? And love to hear from you if you have thought about investing or have bought Bitcoins or Ethers or Dogecoin or whatever other digital currency. Tell us why you did it, what you've done with it, if you're willing to share that story. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about cryptocurrencies, what they are, how they work, whether they're here to stay. Vivian Fang is with us, associate professor and Honeywell professor in accounting at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. She teaches a course on crypto. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions. Maybe your experiences with Bitcoin or other digital currencies. Do you have them? Do you use them? What do you think? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to speak to the history of Bitcoin specifically a little bit. So really, Bitcoin was born out of the bailout decisions from 2008. And that's basically why it was designed the way it was designed, for that deflationary nature of the currency.
Gotcha. John, thanks for the call. Vivian, I think the timing is right there. Was that part of the motivation for creating Bitcoin, worries about inflation, wanting to have it as an extra, I guess, hedge against inflation?
More than that, but he's, you know, partly right. And to understand how cryptocurrencies work, created, we have to do a bit of time traveling. If we go back to the 90s, and when some folks who label themselves as cypherpunks grew increasingly skeptical of central banks. And so they really wanted a decentralized currency that is free from government involvement and intervention. And the worry extends beyond inflation. They want a decentralized currency that is truly native to cyberspace and has nothing to do with the government. And of course, you know, that was just an idea in the 90s, and it was not until 2009 did Bitcoin, the first real cryptocurrency, became a reality.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. You've used that phrase, Vivian, free from government intervention a couple times. Is it necessarily going to stay that way? Our governments around the world, I should say, looking to tax or regulate or do things to intervene in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. Well, I can tell you that there's definitely more regulatory interest and more regulatory efforts in the crypto space over the past 2 years. In my view, regulations are not necessarily a bad thing for cryptocurrencies, because they are necessary to the stability and the mainstream acceptance of cryptocurrencies. And if we look at the big picture, though, the fact that the U.S. government is looking to collect an estimated total of $28 billion worth of crypto tax to fund the infrastructure bill is telling us that the crypto market is probably not going to go away anytime soon.
Let's go back to our callers now. Josh is with us in Madison. Josh, hi.
How you doing? I have kind of two questions. The first one, is there a difference between buying Ethereum and mining Ethereum? And second, is there a trusted source on how to get into it, like a specific YouTube channel, or is it just randomly looking for them?
Josh, thanks for that call. First of all, mining versus buying. In this case, he mentioned Ethereum. They are very different things, right?
Well, they are. You are doing different benefit cost analysis, and you're also comparing the investment to other alternatives. When it comes to investing, right, you just put your money in Ethereum and you are comparing this particular investment versus investing in stock or other type of cryptocurrencies. And if you're looking into mining cryptocurrencies, you are doing an entire different set of calculations. You have to figure out whether the Ethereum that you're able to mine can outweigh the energy cost that you have to pay. So it's a very different type of calculation that you have to do before you decide on either one.
And Josh is wondering about a source for finding out more about Bitcoin. I mean, I assume there's a lot out there on the internet of varying quality. I'm not looking for investment advice for our listeners here, but what kind of things would you suggest somebody do for due diligence before they get into this fairly complicated market?
Absolutely. Well, first, they can always come to the University of Minnesota and take a class with me. But joking aside, there are many books and YouTube videos that people can look up. I really like, excuse me, I really like the open course offered by Princeton on YouTube, but the course is a bit on the tech side. And for basics, I think the book on mastering Bitcoin is a good start. And for crypto related news, Cointelegraph and CoinDesk are also great websites.
Josh, thanks for the call. Good luck if you pursue that. We are talking about cryptocurrency with Vivian Fang from the University of Minnesota. We'll go now to Judith in Milwaukee. Judith, hi.
My question for Vivian and people who are advocating and supporters of Bitcoin and NFTs is, how do you square that with global warming? Okay, Bitcoin mining is a very energy-intensive activity. I mean, we read about it. The livability of neighborhoods that are around these huge data centers is also quite difficult. And to me, Bitcoin's NFT and environmentalism is a huge oxymoron.
Judith, thanks for the call. I've seen concerns, Vivian. A lot of energy goes into the production of these various cryptocurrencies, raising concerns about create climate change emissions. Is that a concern you've run into?
Let me start by saying that it is true that as we stand, mining still consumes a large amount of energy. At the same time, the industry is taking a lot of initiatives to switch to more energy-friendly, more environmental-friendly way of mining. For example, that Ethereum is moving from proof of work to proof of stake, which consumes less energy. And also the industry is investing in a lot of renewable energy efforts and projects. So, I mean, for this industry, energy consumption is a life-death kind of situation. So you can count on them investing in renewable energy, and hopefully that it will require less energy going forward.
Thanks for the call, Judith. I will go now to Todd in northern Wisconsin. Todd, hello.
Good afternoon. If I were interested in buying a cryptocurrency, let's say Bitcoin, and I guess from my understanding, I would have to use dollars to buy that. What would Bitcoin do with those dollars? If cryptocurrency is the currency of the future, how do you pay for it with the currency of the past?
Todd, thanks. What happens to my dollars when I use it to buy Bitcoin, Vivian?
Well, it really depends on where you buy Bitcoin, right? If you buy it from a Bitcoin exchange, or a crypto exchange, or a crypto platform, it goes to the platform. And if you buy from any company, your dollar is going to go to the company or platform because they have to settle using fiat currencies. If you buy in some of the purely crypto trading platform like BISC, then you could go be converted into a different type of cryptocurrencies.
Thanks for the call, Todd. Just one quick experiment, Vivian. If I wanted to start a coin, Robcoin is taken, but Ferretcoin isn't. If I create Ferretcoin with somebody smarter than me who does the blockchain, how does that initial value get set? Do I just pick a number, or what determines its value?
For the most part, yes. That kind of goes back to the first question, right? How do we decide on cryptocurrency value? You can pick a number, but it doesn't mean that you will get that number, right? You can initiate that chain. You can initiate a smart contract in Ethereum, and the value could plummet because the market doesn't buy the value that you set.
Interesting. Vivian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Vivian Fang, associate professor and Honeywell professor in accounting at Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. Talk to her today about cryptocurrencies, what they are, how they work, and what the future may have in store for them. Still time for you to share your thoughts on cryptocurrency, maybe your personal experience if you've dabbled in it on one side or another. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Ferretcoin does not exist yet. Coming up after the news, an education expert joins the show for a closer look at how schools and kids' learning have been affected by the pandemic, and a new set of report cards out from the state looking at schools around Wisconsin. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.